Tuesday, March 16th, 2410. Corwin's first discovery on Tuesday morning was that, while a fine vantage point for taking in a view of Republic City, and an excellent spot for a private conversation, the roof of the White Lotus guard post was not really a good place to sleep. For one thing, it wasn't very comfortable. For another, it faced east. And for a third, it got you some mighty strange looks at breakfast. "I thought you were a Viking," Cora chided him as they entered the refectory. "Used to sleeping in rough conditions." She shook her head sadly. "You wouldn't last a week on the ice pack." Corwin gave her a half-hearted glower, stretching his arms backward. "The ice pack would not..." "Ah!" he interrupted himself as something crackled meatily. "Have left my spine this shape." "Hm. Well, I slept just fine," she said airily. Corwin rolled his eyes. "I'd point out that you had something to put your head on, but the airbender kids are having a hard enough time pretending they're not staring at us already." "Well, not all of them," Cora pointed out, and, following her suggestive eyeline, Corwin saw what she meant. At least one of the young airbenders was paying them no attention at all. Sitting at their table with the rest of the newly expanded crew, Lakpa appeared only to have eyes for Nall. "Hmm," thought Corwin. Stepping to the other side of the table, he bent to kiss first Anthy, then Utrina good morning, then slipped onto the open cushion next to the latter. "Kate got a great photo of you guys just before dawn," said Utrina with a grinning nudge. "I'm thinking of sending it to Emily anonymously." Pouring himself some coffee, Corwin replied mildly, "Elsker, you know that photo of you and Sionji in your sophomore class yearbook?" Utrina made a dismissive gesture. "Oh, pff, Emily wouldn't have any use for that. She doesn't even know Sionji." Anthy giggled. Corwin sighed and buttered some toast. "Speaking of, let's see what's in the morning edition of the Tribune," said Cora cheerfully, extracting section 4 from said paper. "I guess we won't find out until tonight's edition whether Emily owns a telescope," said Anthy with a slightly evil grin. "Ha! Don't even joke," Cora told her. "I've seen him do worse. Although that's usually the guys from the United Daily." She scanned the section's front page, then grinned and said, "Heh, well, she's still on the job, though." She turned the paper around so her fellow breakfasters could see the picture, showing them all emerging from Chow's in a cheerfully chatting mass the night before, and the headline stack below. "A new team avatar? More intriguing strangers arrive by train. Mystery couple, others dine with Avatar Korra. They were very polite, say restaurant staffers." At the bottom right, there was a smaller headline, "And who is this?" next to an arrow pointing to a separate photo. This one showed Amy, dressed in her traveling clothes from the day before, her hair fetchingly tousled from sleeping on the train. It took her a moment to place it, but the bronze-edged doorway behind her and the straightness of her left arm gave it away. It had been taken just as she emerged from Central City Station the previous day. The photo had been cropped so that the egg chest would have been just off the page's right-hand edge. "Well, that's typical," Rory groused. "They've cut me right out of the picture." Cora turned the paper back around and read them a bit of the article, in which Emily Wong speculated that this small invasion of interesting foreigners gathering around our avatar might constitute a new manifestation of the informal special action teams with which Cora had been known to surround herself in the past. She seemed to think this indicated that something big might be in the offing, something that might extend well beyond Section 4, and she was determined to find out what it might be. "I like the kid's moxie," Cora mused, "but I'm afraid she might be setting herself up for a little bit of disappointment with that line of reasoning." Thoughtfully, she got out her gear phone and thumbed a speed dial code. "Chiang, hey." "Yeah, looking at it right now. Has she called you?" "Uh-huh." "Well, she seems to think..." "No, I..." "Well, did you come right out and say they're not working the Comet case with Eitaro and me?" Her brows knitted. "Aw, jeez. You know as well as I do that's as good as confirming it. I don't pay you to make that kind of rookie mistake." She paused and listened for a few moments, then replied, "Well, no, you're right. I don't pay you at all. You have a definite point there." "Well, partly because I don't have anything to pay you with, unless you have some pressing use for fishing rights in Pangnyktuwuk Fjord." "Look, we're getting off topic here. If she calls back, see what you can do about defusing that." "No, it's only for a couple more days. We'll let her off the hook before Corwin and the gang head home." "Okay." "Yeah. Thanks. See ya." Turning off the phone, Cora regarded it for a second, then pocketed it. Then she smiled ruefully at Corwin and Utna and said, "Boy, I hope you guys have a good payoff plan for that girl." "I thought we did, but she's sort of going above and beyond," Utna admitted. "We may have to go bigger." Cora considered the paper for a moment, then folded it up, set it aside, and said, "I should probably get out the hat while we're running around today, just so I don't get mobbed at the museum." At Utrina's curious look, she smiled and said, "You'll see." When those who were heading to the Avatar Museum gathered in the courtyard an hour later, several of them were a bit bemused to see that Cora appeared to be wearing a half-hearted disguise. Consisting solely of a minor hairstyle change and a light camelophant hair overcoat and cloche hat added to her regular clothes, this seemed like it would be about as effective at concealing her identity as Schnoz glasses. She didn't seem concerned, though, and, slightly to some of her friends' amazement, it seemed to work. She wasn't acting like she was trying to be incognito. But even though they arrived on Aang Memorial Island by Sky Bison, and no one could possibly have failed to recognize her, people acted as if they didn't. "What's going on?" Rory murmured to Amy as the dozenth or so person in the museum didn't swoop in seeking an autograph. "Why doesn't anyone recognize Cora?" Amy shrugged and probably would have asked how he figured she would know. But before she could, Nima leaned smilingly over and explained quietly, "Everybody does, but it's an old, old custom in Republic City that no one acknowledges it when she's wearing the hat. The tradition goes back generations. It's the city's way of giving her some space." Amy raised one coppery eyebrow. "And that works?" Nima nodded. "Usually. Sometimes tourists and people who are new in town don't realize, but the locals usually set them straight." "Huh," said Rory. "The people at my high school do something similar with one of my classmates," Anne mused, smiling. "I mean, we all know he's Robin, but it would be rude to rub his nose in it." The building beneath the colossal statue of Avatar Aang on his Memorial Island had originally been the entire Avatar Museum, but as that institution's prestige had grown and its collection had expanded, it had rapidly outgrown the facility. Today, for the most part, only the items most directly connected with that particular avatar were housed there. The rest were housed in a large and splendid edifice on the mainland, across the courtyard from the United Republic Museum, with which it was affiliated. The Aang collection took up a good chunk of the morning, and filled in many of the gaps that had been left in Utana's understanding of his history by the United Republic Museum, in part because the Avatar Museum was also bilingual in its signage, but its standard placards were actually intelligible. "Well, thank you," said Korra with a smile, when Utana related this fact to her. "I wrote the copy for these myself, here and at the downtown museum. Took me about a year. One of these days I ought to touch up the URMs, but I keep finding more interesting things to do." Utana laughed. "Okay, fair enough," she said. In addition to the regular ferry service to Air Temple Island, there were scheduled ferry runs between Aang Memorial Island and the mainland, the better to link the two halves of the museum together. It was this, rather than another sky bison hop, that the group used when they'd finished the island's collection. This positioned them nicely for lunch at the mainland museum's much larger and more elaborate cafeteria. They ate in the outdoor part, which was configured as a sort of sculptural garden, featuring statues of various avatars that had been salvaged from various places around the world. "What's the story with this?" Kate wondered, pausing with her tray of food in front of a badly damaged statue. It looked as if it had once depicted a tall, thin, bearded man, but it was partly broken and partly melted, so more than that was difficult to say. "That's Avatar Roku," said Korra, "the one before Aang. This was in the Fire Temple on Crescent Island. Roku was not pleased that the Fire Sages threw their support behind Azulon and Ozai during the Hundred Year War. When Aang made contact with him at the temple, he showed his displeasure with a volcanic eruption. Shame, really. The Fire Temple was a pretty historic place, but..." She shrugged. "I wasn't born then, and Aang was a little preoccupied with just getting out alive. It was that kind of day. He had a lot of that kind of day that year." "Ah," said Kate, nodding, and they moved on. They found a big enough table for everyone, in the shade of the garden's biggest statue. This reminded Kate of the great stone Buddha outside the New Avalon Zen Center. It was in a similar seated pose, and on a similar scale, probably two stories high. But instead of a thin man in a tunic, this depicted a woman in airbender garb, the arrow on her high, shaved forehead carved in relief so that it would be more obvious. Heavily weathered and mottled with patches of moss, the statue had an air of ancient gravity and repose, but there was something a bit haughty in the angle of the airbender's head, the set of her jaw. "Hey, Nima, I thought airbenders were humble and retiring folk," Amy mused, looking up at the statue. "We are," Nima said. "Or we try to be, anyway." "I think the person represented by this statue may have missed the memo," said Rory dryly. "It's Avatar Yangchen," Nima conceded. "She had a reputation for being reasonably impressed with her achievements. Keep in mind, though, that almost all these statues were commissioned by people other than those they represent," Korra pointed out. "I mean, you don't think Aang himself had anything to do with the huge Aang statue in the harbor, do you? He's still a little embarrassed about that." "What about you, Korra?" asked Anthy. Korra hesitated. "Well," she admitted, "there is one at the Southern Air Temple, but that's because there's one of every avatar there, and I don't think it's really idealized. I mean, they're all pretty basic. I'm just standing there next to Aang. It actually looks like we're all in line at the DMV. "I saw one in Senna once," Corwin objected. Korra laughed. "That was ice," she said. "They do that every year on my birthday. And then every spring, everyone in town bets on when it'll fall down." That got a laugh around the table, and the conversation turned to other matters for the rest of lunch. They came back to the same topic, however, almost immediately upon going back inside, for the high-arched entrance to the Avatar Korra gallery was flanked by two enormous banners bearing her mildly stylized likeness. 20 feet high, she stood vivid in pale blue against a dark blue background, one hand on cocked hip, the other in a loose fist at her side. The artist had clearly been aiming to make a statement, depicting her as tough, sassy, literally larger than life, ready for her close-up or a fight, whichever happened to offer itself. "I always feel a little narcissistic coming in here," said Korra a trifle ruefully. Looking up at one of the banners, she added, "Of course, the giant Avatar Korra equals badass babe posters don't help with that." Which brings us neatly back to what I was saying before. She regarded the flattering image thoughtfully for a second, then turned to Caitlin and remarked, "You know, in hindsight, it's embarrassing how obvious this is. I'll say this for Tarlok. He was a weasel snake, but he was upfront about it." Kate didn't reply. She just gave the Avatar a sly little smile. "You're gonna do it, aren't you?" said Korra, her shoulders sagging. "You know I am," Kate replied, holding up her mini-camera. Korra gave a long, suffering sigh, then took the camera from her and said, "Okay, everybody group up." Then, while the others all arranged themselves in front of the banner on the left, Korra scanned the passing museum-goers before settling on a young man in a Ba Sing Se University sweatshirt. "Excuse me, sir?" she said, approaching him with her most winning smile. "Would you mind getting our picture in front of the banner here?" Surprised, the young man pulled up short, looked from her to the group under the banner and back, then smiled and said, sure, no problem." Korra handed him the camera. "Thanks. Yeah, just press this here," she confirmed, pointing to the button his finger had already found. "Right. Maybe one close up so everybody's face shows up, and then another one from back there so the whole banner fits in," she suggested, pointing to a spot at the far end of the corridor leading back to the Avatars Before Sozin's Comet wing. He nodded. "Okay, that sounds good." Then he blinked in sudden realization, looked quickly from Korra to the banner and back a couple of times, and said in a quiet, hesitant voice, "Are you?" "Shh," said Korra, putting a finger to her lips. "Careful. I don't mind. But if the locals catch you recognizing me while I'm wearing this hat, they'll shun you." She winked. "It's a Republic City thing." The young man looked puzzled, then shrugged. "Okay. "Thanks, you're a pal," said Korra, clapping him on the shoulder. Then she headed back to the rest of the group and fitted herself into the spot they'd left for her in the middle. The young man took a couple of close shots, then retired to the other end of the hall and shot a few more frames from there, before returning and handing the camera back with a shy smile. "There you go, miss," he said, reddening slightly. "Perfect," said Korra, checking the pictures. "Hey, what's your name?" she asked. "Yang," said the young man automatically. "Yang Tao." Korra smiled at him again. "Well, Tao, we really appreciate your help." Turning to the camera's owner, she returned it and held out her empty hand. "Hey, Kate, give me a yuan. No, not a coin, a bill." Money in hand, she got out a felt-tip pen from an inside pocket of her overcoat, turned Corwin around, and used his back as a desk to jot a quick note on the back of the bill. "And there," she said, then capped the pen, put it away, and tucked the bill into Yang's hand, telling him, "Thanks again. Have a great day." "Thank you," said Yang, his face almost blank with bemusement, except for a lingering slight blush. "You too," he added, then moved off in his originally planned direction. "That young man is utterly confounded," Anthea observed with a fond smile. "And probably in love," Utena agreed. "The two sensations are often difficult to distinguish," said Corwin sagely. "Tell me about it," Cora mumbled, almost inaudibly. "The wisdom of the Trinity, ladies and gentlemen," a grinning Nall put in, drawing a giggle from Lakpa. Nima gave her sister a suspicious glance, then ignored her as they all trooped through the archway into the exhibit area itself. There were a few thin spots here, mainly to do with things that were better represented in their larger historical contexts elsewhere. The Equalist Revolt, for instance, was covered in greater detail at the United Republic Museum, and Project Phoenix Flight had its own museum all to itself in the Fire Nation, as well as the displays in the lobby of the Phoenix House Hotel. For the most part, though, the gallery presented a fairly comprehensive, and even reasonably impartial, overview of Cora's long career to date. The most obvious items were pieces of machinery. In one corner, surrounded by a velvet rope, stood an old friend, the black and silver shape of the Cora-mobile, freshly polished back to a showroom shine. Utena laughed at the sight of it and went over for a closer look. Even right up next to it, she'd hardly have known that just the day before yesterday, she'd been driving it around the city. It looked like it had been there, meticulously dusted but otherwise untouched, for decades. Next to it, on a small plinth, stood a descriptive sign in Tongyu and Standard. "This 2289 Future Industries P2X Touring Roadster is one of two that were used by Avatar Cora and her friends to patrol Republic City and its environs in the 2290s. The first was destroyed during the Equalist Rebellion." "Oh," Utena remarked upon reading it. "So it really was the Cora-mobile." "Yeah, pretty much," Cora replied, smiling nostalgically. "Ah, those were the days." The other, larger and more obvious machine, stood along the back wall, surrounded by other items pertaining to the Avatar's long association with the Sato family and its various enterprises. To the unfamiliar eye of Amy, who was the first to notice it, it looked like a cross between a tank, a freight loader, and an old-timey diving suit, complete with a head that resembled such a suit's spherical, many-windowed helmet. This one wouldn't have been much good for diving, though. Several of its greenish glass windows were only fragmentary, and the metal framework that had surrounded them was bent. The machine's oddly lustrous silvery armor was dented and scratched in several other places. Plainly, it had not been painstakingly restored to factory condition before being put on display. "Hey, what's this doing here?" Corwin wondered. "Last time I saw it, it was at the Sato." "We switch the exhibits around sometimes," Cora explained. "Our car from the 93 Future City GP is over there right now, for instance." "What is it?" Amy wondered. "Some kind of industrial machine." "Sort of," said Cora. "Corwin, I believe this is your area," she went on, adding with a faint smirk, "God of Mecca." Corwin bowed sardonically to her, then told Amy, "This is in fact what happens when an authentic wacko retasks an industrial load lifter as a terror weapon. Under the platinum armor, you heard me, and the grappling hooks, which are also tasers. Again, you heard me. It's a forklift. Hey, don't knock it, Cora said, and the others all got the impression, well, Caitlin knew for a fact, that this was a conversation they'd had before. These things were very much an out-of-context problem until we got enough breathing room to actually think about how to defeat them. You definitely don't want a bunch of them coming after you in a locked warehouse, she added. Which happened? Why platinum? Rory wondered. That must have cost an absolute fortune. Metal benders can't bend it, too highly refined, and I guess gold was too blingy, said Corwin. Then, twirling a fingertip next to his temple, he added, Remember, authentic wacko. He grinned at Cora. I do have to concede they were effective. I mean, the historical record is clear on that point. And hey, I'll be the first to acknowledge that in mecha design, sometimes crazy works. He shook his head. 2 tons of platinum per unit, though. In today's money back home, that would be something like 100 million credits apiece, and that's just for the hull. That doesn't even take into account internal components, actuators, dynamo generators, research and design, labor costs, tooling, logistics, fabrication, the actual robot. Yep, Cora agreed. Turns out backing a terrorist conspiracy isn't really a viable business model. That's one of the main reasons why this is the last one left. The others had to be scrapped to reclaim the platinum. No wonder Future Industries nearly went bankrupt after Hiroshi went to prison. He'd redirected the entire world's supply of the most valuable known metal of the time into this one project for something like 2 years. Even by his standards, that was pricey. Corwin smiled sentimentally at the old machine. I don't want you guys to get the wrong impression here, he said, mainly to Rory and Amy. I have a real fondness for these nutty things. They're crazy and stupid and impractical in every way, but they've got style. I wish someone had thought to preserve one of the ones with the giant magnets I saw in a book once, he added with a grin. Those were great. On some level, I can't help but be tickled that that even worked. The tin heads must have felt like they'd just been defeated by Wile E. Coyote. Be nice, Cora chided him mildly. We didn't have plastics yet. Or aluminum or austenitic stainless steel, said Corwin mischievously. Neither of which would have helped with the conductivity problem, as you well know, and we're losing our audience, said Cora with a grin, noting the increasingly bemused looks on several of their companions' faces. Anyway, she went on, guys, you'll be pleased to know that this story has a happy ending. She gestured to the exhibit they'd been discussing. The original mecha tanks were horribly wasteful and really dangerous, and they were used by the wrong people to do bad things. But the second generation revolutionized the construction industry. Without mega builders, it would have taken years to rebuild Gaoling after the earthquake. Which is a clean segue into the next part of the museum, said Nima cheerfully. Cora pointed to her. Correct. 2 points for Master Nima, she declared, offering a hand for a high five. They went from the Avatar Museum straight to the Professional Bending Hall of Fame, a smaller and more specialized establishment in a utilitarian but handsome building adjoining Shiro Shinobi Arena. Much of what was presented here went over the Outworlders' heads entirely, since, being an unfamiliar sports Hall of Fame, it was mainly concerned with enshrining bygone athletes of whom few of them had ever heard, and who had played a game few of them had ever seen. Corwin and Kate, pro-bending fans from way back, had been there before and enjoyed checking it out again. Anne was intrigued thanks to her newfound interest in firebending, and Utena and Anthy were up for anything that might add to their growing stock of insight into this world and its people. But Amy and Rory mainly concentrated on the old video games in the atrium by the snack bar. Before splitting up to follow their own whims, though, they did have to pass the display near the entryway, having to do with, what else, the Avatar's own professional bending career. This was reasonably understated as these things went, largely at Korra's own insistence, but she couldn't have prevented it outright. Like it or not, she was a key figure in the sport, not because she had been a really great player, she herself would insist that she'd never been more than pretty good, but because she'd been the first, and so far the only, Avatar to play the game at all. Her interest, and ultimately participation, in the sport had legitimized it, in the eyes of a good many members of the public, starting it on its path from its somewhat shady, semi-organized roots to mainstream popularity. There were still those who claimed that it had been better before that happened, that the modern game was too clean and corporate to be really cool. But, as Avatar Aang's brother-in-law, the great second-century swordsman, painter, and poet Master Sokka said, "Haters gonna hate." The really interesting thing to Anthy about the Korra display at the Pro Bending Hall of Fame was that it was not, as some of the others, she noticed later, were, gushingly congratulatory. Her career stats were presented, as with all the players enshrined in the hall, without comment or embellishment, and it had to be admitted that they contained few superlatives. The mannequin displaying her Future Industries Fire Ferret's uniform, as well as those wearing the uniforms of her two teammates, were not posed in dramatic or flattering style, but just stood there, showing the uniforms and nothing more. And then there was the painting. This showed a pro-bending arena, an earlier iteration of Shinobi Arena, presumably, with a match in progress between the Fire Ferrets and some other, fairly generically rendered team. Korra was unmistakable in her blue waterbender's sash, the lines of her body squared off only slightly by the padding of her uniform, her high ponytail protruding from the back of her skeleton helmet. She was shown in a fighting stance, directing a stream of water that had just knocked one of the other fighters over the ropes and off the side of the arena. At the side of the scene, standing on his platform, one of the referees was in the process of unfurling a fan, its surface a bright canary yellow. "Are you getting a penalty?" Anne wondered. Korra, hands on hips, grinned wryly at the painting. "Yep," she said. "Ah, my favorite painting of myself," she added sarcastically. "This could be used as a bookend with Tarlok's giant banner in an exhibition, the least and most flattering portrayals of Avatar Korra." Then she shrugged. "I did tell him not to make me out to be some kind of superhero, but I think they might have been a little too diligent about it," she added with a wink for the young samurai. At 3:30, they adjourned to Shiro Shinobi Arena itself. Korra eschewed the fancy VIP box seats in favor of the bleachers, which she claimed was the only way to really watch a pro-bending match. The magic of the hat continued working. Those seated around them seemed more interested in the gang of obvious foreigners than the equally obvious fact that the Avatar was with them. Anne supposed Korra was probably a pretty well-known quantity in these particular parts anyway. In the few minutes before the afternoon's exhibition matches began, Korra gave the newcomers a quick rundown of the rules. These mainly had to do with what did and did not constitute fair uses of bending. Earth and firebenders, for instance, were forbidden to direct their elements at the opponent's heads, while neither fire nor waterbenders could sustain a streamed assault for more than a second. Territorial matters involving the various lines on the court, and questions of timing and scoring. It seemed like a fairly simple game, all things considered. Then play began, and they saw it wasn't really as simple as the basic rules made it appear. There was quite a bit of strategy involved, and, strangely for what was essentially a combat sport, a lot of restraint. Players weren't allowed to actually fight one another. They weren't, in fact, allowed to be in the same sectors of the court at the same time. In practice, that meant it was a game that was largely about positioning, knowing one's own and one's teammates, working out ways of disrupting or exploiting the other sides. This was the first exhibition of the year, not even part of the official preseason, which didn't begin until the following week, and so the teams were all at least a bit rusty. In some cases, a lot rusty, to the point where even the untrained observers among Cora's guests wondered whether the players had done anything over the off-season that didn't involve a couch and a remote control. This occasionally made for good comedy, and just as often, good Schadenfreude. Before long, even the more mystified of the newcomers was into it, picking sides more or less arbitrarily. Anne noticed with a little grin that Rory and Amy tended to pick the opposite ones, while Anthy seemed to have a quiet preference for whoever was losing, and Uchna a not-so-quiet one for whoever was doing whatever they were doing, winning or losing, with the most heart. During the brief intermission following the fourth preliminary match, a battle of two teams from the far-flung Siwang Desert, in which the Night Vale Spider Wolves narrowly defeated their arch-rivals, the Desert Bluff's Sun Beetles, Cora was mildly surprised, and slightly nonplussed, to receive a call on her silenced gearphone. As there wasn't any actual play in progress just then, though, she decided she'd better answer it. And so, with a mumbled apology to her companions, she withdrew to the aisle and did so. Hello? Oh, hey, we're just waiting for you. She held the phone away from her head for a second to scowl at it, then put it hastily back and said, Wait, what? Run that by me again? What do you mean he didn't make his flight? Seriously? And he couldn't get rerouted? Another interjection from the caller. Okay, calm down. Look, as long as that storm isn't going to hit any major residential areas, there's very little I can do about it, especially in this kind of time. I mean, at this point, I couldn't even get there before it was all over. Maybe if you'd called yesterday. Yes, I know. Enduring a brief storm of objection from the person who had called her, Cora sighed and pinched the bridge of her nose. Look, it's not like it's not even spring training, never mind the regular season. And you know the fuss they'd make if I stepped in at the last second, even for an exhibition match. I really don't think there's anything I can do for... She trailed off, looking back toward her vacant seat. Next to it, Corwin was leaning down and explaining something about the rules of the game to Anne, using fighter pilot-y gestures to do it. Cora considered this for a moment, her caller repeating, "Hello? Hello?" in her ear, then slowly smiled. "On second thought, I'll be right there," she said, then snapped the phone shut before any question could be forthcoming, put it away, and waded back to her seat. "So," she said cheerfully, "while we're waiting for the next match, who wants refills?" Pointing to various companions, she ticked off their preferred snacks. "Popcorn, fire flakes, soda, lychee juice? Rory, more rice balls? Amy, you want another squid on a stick?" She rubbed her hands together with glee as everyone relayed their orders, then said briskly, Good. Corwin, you're with me." "Cora, this isn't the way to the concession stands," Corwin observed a minute or so later, as she half-led, half-dragged him by the hand into the employees-only area of the arena. He'd been here before, on the special tour, but not for a number of years. "Not much gets by you, Corwin," she said cheerfully, leading him around a corner and into what he recognized as one of the hallways, where the dressing rooms were. As they moved down the hall, she took off the hat, with the hand not occupied with dragging him along. "So you say you're an earthbender now, Corwin?" Cora asked. She gave him a sly grin and said, "Well, it's time to put your yuans where your yapper is. then hustled him through a door and into one of the dressing rooms. Unlike the locker rooms in any other gym or sporting venue he could think of, those at Shinobi Arena were as pleasantly decorated as the rest of the facility. The designers had made no distinction between the areas of the arena that were to be seen by the public and those that weren't. There were already two people in the room, both women, one dressed in a red and white Temple Island Fire Ferret's uniform, the other only about halfway there. Neither seemed dismayed that the Avatar had just barged into their dressing room and brought a slightly bewildered-looking young man with her. "Right," Korra declared, striking a triumphant here-he-is pose. "You guys can relax. I found you an earthbender." Corwin glanced sharply at her. "You what?" The young woman who was still dressing finished pulling her jersey over her head, raked her hands through her short brown hair, and only then took a look at the new arrival. When she did, she blurted, "Corwin?" "Karana," Corwin replied, equally surprised. The other woman shook her head with an indulgent little smile and asked him rhetorically, "You really do know everybody, don't you?" Corwin, already a bit at a loss, took a second or so to realize that he knew her. "What? Azana?" Regaining his aplomb quickly, he smiled. "I didn't realize you were a pro bender." "And I didn't realize you were a bender at all, so I guess that makes us even," Azana replied with a grin. "So, are you any good? For starters, do you know the rules? Are you at least aware that you can't knock people off the sides?" Karana asked impishly. "One time," Korra objected. "I did that one time." Pointing mock-threateningly at Karana, she went on, "Listen, Missy, I brought you into this world. I can show you back out." Karana didn't seem impressed by the threat. She just rolled her eyes in a distinctly un-dealing-with-the-Avatar-like manner, then returned to securing her uniform. Still smiling, Azana guided Corwin to one of the cabinets, they were really far too nice to call them lockers, along one side of the room. "Here," she said, opening it up. "Juan's spare uniform ought to fit you reasonably well. He's a big guy." She frowned. "Hang on, you can't wear his number, though." "That's okay, Zana. We've got, what, 6 minutes?" Karana asked breezily. She took the uniform jersey out of the cabinet on its hanger and tossed it casually to Korra. "I'm sure Gran-Gran can sew that fast if she puts her mind to it. She is the Avatar, after all." Korra gave a put-upon sigh, carried the jersey to the low cabinet on the other side of the room, put down the hat off to one side, and opened one of the drawers, hunting for the spare numbers and sewing supplies. "You guys just don't respect me," she mocked, grumbled, "and do not call me Gran-Gran. Corwin, what number do you want? Anything above 60 should be available." While Korra removed the team's usual earthbender's number from the back of the spare jersey and affixed another one, Karana and Azana got Corwin into the rest of the gear. As Azana had predicted, it fit reasonably well, once they'd adjusted a few of the straps and buckles a bit. He was getting the feel of the light torso armor, how it flexed and how it didn't, when a man in a suit poked his head in the door and asked if everything was all right. "It is now," said Karana cheerfully as she finished helping Corwin with the last of the adjustments he wanted to the armor. "We'll be ready to go in a minute." "You're making a substitution? Make sure you file your 74D by the end of the day," the official warned them. "We don't want another protest." "It was an honest mistake," Karana complained. "Anyway, Korra vouches for him. She'll take care of it while we're whipping the ice wraiths," she added with a grin. "Oh, Avatar, I didn't see you there," said the official. "Surprised you're not taking the field yourself for old time's sake," he added with a little smile. Not this time, Huan Dao. There wasn't enough warning for effective crowd control, said Cora wryly. The management appreciates your discretion, said Huan Dao with a short bow. Well, I'll leave you to it. He consulted a pocket watch, then put it away and said, You have 90 seconds. Good luck out there, before departing. Jersey's ready, said Cora. She handed it to Karana, who dragged it unceremoniously over Corwin's head. While he got his arms through the sleeves and then sorted out his gloves and forearm guards, Azana knotted the green belt, marking him, along with his number color and a stripe on his helmet, as the team's earthbender around his waist. Finally, Cora stepped up, holding a green-striped, open-topped helmet with a transparent face shield. Slightly to his surprise, she leaned up on tiptoes and kissed him on the cheek, murmuring, For luck, before reaching up and fitting the helmet onto his head, then fastening the chin strap. There, she said, clapping her hands to the padded sides of his helmet as if trying to box his ears. She wiggled the helmet a little, making sure it wasn't going anywhere, then stepped back and grinned. Now you're... She hesitated, her face going slightly blank as she got a good look at him in the complete kit. Fully... regulation. Corwin gave her a puzzled look, which only heightened the resemblance that had stopped her in the first place. His eyes were the wrong color, but that wasn't apparent through the slight tint of the face shield anyway, and he was too tall, much too tall. But in this light, in that outfit, on a day that was full of nostalgic reminders of times gone by anyway. Cora? He asked, his voice snapping her back to the present. You okay? You went away on me for a second there. Cora shook her head, not to say no, but to finish returning from her reverie. Yeah, sorry, I just... All kitted out like that, you suddenly reminded me of... She smiled sentimentally. Your father's phrase for it is, the elder days. He nodded, an understanding smile crossing his face, and gripped her shoulder gently. Fully recovered now, she grinned and gave his left shoulder pad a stout thump. Go get him, killer, she said. Back in the stands, Cora and Corwin's friends were starting to suspect that something peculiar was going on, but before they really got a chance to discuss it amongst themselves, they found themselves approached by a pretty, auburn-haired young woman in stylish green and gold Earth Kingdom dress. There you are. I knew I'd find you eventually, she said, smiling. Hey, Maki, said Nall, as everyone in row 4 budged over a bit so the Kyoshi warrior would have a place to join them. I almost didn't recognize you without your face on, he added, grinning. Occasionally, we do like to be able to walk down the street without stopping traffic, said Maki. She looked over the group. Have I met everyone? I think so. Hang on. Where are Corwin and Cora? An excellent question, said Anthy Riley. Went to get some more munchies. And now she's coming back without him, Nall mused. For indeed, Cora, back under the protection of the hat, was making her way toward them, carrying a large, shallow cardboard box full of various concession items, and she did very much appear to be alone. Cora doesn't carry money, Lakpa pointed out, then added matter-of-factly, She must have traded him for our food. Sorry about that, bit of a line at the seal jerky stand, Cora said as she came within earshot. Oh, hey, Maki, good to see you. You just missed the snack run, but I'm sure there'll be another. Where's Corwin? Nall wondered. He had to use the little bender's room, Cora replied offhandedly. K Kate gave her a look that said she very much doubted that was the case, but didn't care to press the issue. Cora winked at her, then got down to distributing snacks. Now let's see here. Popcorn for Utena, flaming fireflakes for Enthi and Anne, candy floss for Kate, squid on a stick for Mrs. Williams, rice balls for Mr. Pond, pine pear sections for Nima, lychee juice for Lockpa, Filet-O cat gator for Nall, and this is my seal jerky. Did I miss anybody? Don't give me that look, Lockpa. I'm off the island. I can have as much blubbered seal jerky as I want. That was the deal. Take it up with your great-grand-gran if you dare. Yeah, I thought not. She folded up the box and stashed it under her seat. Don't let me forget to take that to the barrel when we leave. I hate it when people leave trash in the stands. Utena gave her a few seconds to get situated and start in on her seal jerky, then leaned toward her and said dryly, Cora, at the risk of sounding bourgeois, what have you done with my husband? Arranged a world-expanding experience for him, of course. Cora replied blithely, drawing an explosive cough from Nall. Before Utena could investigate further, the platforms bearing the next two teams from the sidelines departed from their staging areas and began moving toward the elevated court at the center of the arena. Ladies and gentlemen, the PA announcer's voice boomed. It's time for tonight's main event. On the blue side, your challengers. They started out last season with high hopes, but then went a disappointing 19-23, finishing the regular season 4.5 games back in the Eastern League, so you can bet they've been training hard this off-season. The Frostbite Point Ice Wraiths. The players who stepped from one platform onto the blue end of the lozenge-shaped playing surface were a tough-looking trio, two men and a woman. Their uniforms were mostly a pale ice blue, with silvery white accents, and the logo on their chests was a stylized depiction of some weirdly spiky serpentine creature with very large, pointy teeth. Wearing the red, number 32, the announcer went on. The Eastern League's leader in knockouts and penalties served, Zanya. Zanya, standing in the center of the formation with arms folded, didn't even bother waving to the crowd, which was just as well, since many of them were booing her. She had a sour expression that was plain even at this distance, through the tinted face guard of her helmet, and she wore a patch over her left eye. Wearing the blue, number 12. A native son of Frostbite Point, who's hoping to turn things around for his hometown this year? Kasa! Kasa was a tall and burly man, unusually so for a water tribesman, with the aquiline nose and faintly disdainful demeanor common to a particular clan in the north. He at least deigned to give the stance a wave, and in return the Republic City crowd didn't boo him quite so vigorously as they had his firebending teammate. And wearing the green number 6, the winner of last year's Earth Rumble, eager to see how his skills translate to the MLB stage, Dr. Rockalanch himself, Genju Wan. This guy, now he was a showman, and unlike his teammates, he knew how to work a room. He strutted, a bit comically, given that he was a full head shorter than either of his teammates, to his place, hands clasped above his head, as if he'd already won. The home crowd didn't seem to know quite what to make of that. He got a few laughs, and more cheers than boos. And on the red side, the announcer went on, clearly a bit more enthusiastic for the home team. Your defending Western League champions, the Temple Island Fire Ferrets! Wearing the red number 1, the top-scoring firebender and last year's league MVP, the Flame of the West, Azana! Utena blinked in surprise, then looked at Anne, who was yelling, Woo! Go Azana! As the firebender gave the room a cheery wave. In the blue, number 7, the South Pole's finest, icy cool Karana. Now, as the grinning waterbender struck a rather Korra-like, hip-shot, check-out-this-biceps pose, it was Nall's turn to look surprised, and then to let out a whistle and an encouraging shout. Utina took that to mean he knew Karana from somewhere, as she knew Azana, and like Utina, he hadn't been expecting to see her here. And, ladies and gentlemen, we have a Rule 74 substitution. It appears that Xiang Wan is stranded in Gaoling due to inclement weather. In his place, sporting the green number 99, making his major league bending debut, the completely unknown Watari Karasu. This announcement received polite applause from most, up-for-anything cheers from the diehards, and a few disappointed boos from particular Xiang Wan fans, except in the section where Korra and her friends were sitting. There, as the substitute earthbender stepped to his place with a wry salute directed specifically at them, the response was first a sound like a collective, "What?" and then vigorous cheering and whistling. Maki was distracted from her part of the cheering by the sudden arrival of a small red and white animal, which scampered down the aisle from above, darted down the row, and climbed up the outside of her trouser leg into her lap. "Hey, a ferret," Amy observed, then looked more closely and saw that the creature was wearing a tailored garment with the Fire Ferret's logo on the back. "In a jacket." Noting the object the new visitor was in the process of presenting to Maki, she added, "And he seems to have brought you a squid on a stick." She shook her head, grinning. "It's a Dr. Seuss book in here all of a sudden." "Why, thank you, Pabu," said Maki pleasantly, accepting the offer and petting the animal on the head. "You won't be able to see anything from there, though. Here, I know." She picked up the ferret, turned him around, and placed him opposite Makoto. "You can have Anthe's other shoulder. Best seat in the house." "All right, this is definitely a conspiracy now," Nall grumped. "You can sit on my shoulder if you want," Lakpa told him, hugging his arm with a cheesy grin. One row in front of her, Nima made a retching noise and got kicked lightly in the back for her trouble. "Who's this now?" asked Anthe with a smile as the ferret and Makoto sniffed tentatively at one another's nose in front of her chin. "That," said Korra grandly, "is Pabu the 17th, the official mascot of the Temple Island Fire Ferrets." She grinned and nodded toward the court as the bell rang to kick off round one. "Officially, he's Karana's, but she's sort of busy right now.